Laudator Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello, and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick, and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, Darwin on the agenda at one pontifical university here in Rome. Protocol and peals of laughter at the court of a 20th century pope. And our weekly rendezvous with our popular Latin lover. Well, thanks for joining me once again. It may have been a quiet week in the Vatican as Benedict XVI is on his Lenten spiritual exercises, but it certainly wasn't a quiet one at one of the pontifical universities here in Rome, where a conference by the title Biological Evolution, Facts and Theories, a Critical Appraisal a Century and a Half Since Charles Darwin's The Origin of Species, was taking place. Yes, this cornerstone of evolutionary biology is the theme currently being discussed by a great number of academics from across the world at this pontifical university, which happens to be the Jesuit Gregorian, which indeed organised this conference in collaboration with the University of Notre Dame under the high patronage of the Pontifical Council for Culture. The thinking behind this conference is that in the light of recent scientific developments, this issue of biological evolution clearly deserves careful and serious reconsideration from a scientific point of view, but also from a philosophical and theological perspective, in an effort to avoid ideological positions that have so often dominated the debate. Irene Lagan went along to the conference and spoke to one of the guests there. He began by introducing himself and indeed by greeting all of you. Let's listen.
Hi, I'm Jeff Fader. I'm a professor at the University of Notre Dame and a fellow at the Wissenschaft College zu Berlin.
Why is this conference important?
Well, it shows that the church is not opposed to the ideas of evolution and accepts that natural processes could be responsible for generating the great diversity of life. And I think that's an important message to the flock and the faithful of the church to understand that. So that's why I think that this, why this particular conference is very important in showing that this is the church's thinking. It's not in opposition to faith.
One of the topics that's going to be discussed, or that is being discussed at this conference, is intelligent design. What is exactly intelligent design? Where did this come from? Where did it begin?
Well, it's an oxymoron. There's nothing intelligently designed, really, in nature when you get down to it. It's all jerry-rigged. Evolution works on the material that it's handed with, and natural selection is the same. So there's nothing really that's intelligently designed. The idea is that there are natural phenotypes, or that there are things in nature that are organismally based that can't be reduced in their complexity, that can't be explained by evolution in steps or stages. And that's just not the case. It's not true. And the ideas date back probably to William Paley, but William Behe has more recently picked up the argument on intelligent design. And when one understands, for instance, things like when you look at an eye and it's so complicated and how did all of these pieces evolve? Well, they didn't evolve all at once. It isn't like a tornado coming through a junkyard and suddenly assembling this miraculous structure that allows us to see light. It didn't. It happened in stages. First, there may have been photopigments that came to be that helped direct an organism at a certain stage, and it changed through times. Lenses then came into being to help focus the light. So it's not a single huge step at once. It's tiny steps that are each individually favored that led to eyes.
The title of your talk is The Mystery of Speciation. Here you have Charles Darwin once described speciation as the mystery of mysteries. Now, you are going to shed light on advances in our understanding of this process. Could you just describe a little bit about how we are to understand this process and maybe a word of what exactly that means? I'm taking it to mean a diversification of species.
Yeah. Darwin used the word mystery not so much in the sense that he didn't understand that speciation was a natural process generating the great diversity of life on Earth. He used it more in a sense of awe and fascination that worldly processes could lead through things like natural selection to the genesis or generation of new species. And I think that was the real mystery in solving that mystery in terms of natural processes that drove Darwin.
So how should, then, people speak intelligently of evolution from a perspective of faith?
Should recognize that there are things in the natural world that are not metaphysical, that materialistic processes can explain the genesis of new species. And this isn't a realm for faith, it's the realm of science. And that these new origins of species, it's not just deduction. We can actually test and show how these new species form.
What do scientists have to say to theologians on this issue and vice versa?
I think that in some sense, evolution and speciation is beyond the realm of engagement for theologians or for faith. It's a field where we can frame hypothesis, and we can go out and do specific scientific tests, and it's got a materialistic basis. Where I think it's more important is to understand that we all have something to contribute to our understanding of life and of being human and of being part of this universe, and that we can all sort of harness our individual knowledge and skills collectively to make a difference. And by talking together and understanding each other on that point, instead of these conflicts, we can use what we know in our given spheres of understanding to help humanity and alleviate human pain and suffering. And I think that's the most important thing.
You were listening there to Professor Jeffrey Feder, one of the guests at the conference focusing on biological evolution, currently taking place at the Pontifical Gregorian University here in Rome. Our thanks to him and, of course, to Irene Lagan. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, I'd like to mention another conference which recently took place, this time within Vatican walls, which brought together another set of academics, historians on this occasion, to discuss the concern for the Church of Pius XI in the light of new archive documentation. It was a meeting timed to coincide with a double February anniversary, the 80th of the birth of Vatican City State at the hand of this Pope who, as we know, brought an end to the Roman question with the Lateran Pax, and the 70th of his death in 1939. After a 16-year pontificate. Anniversaries I myself chose to highlight over the past few weeks in a very personal manner, bringing new echoes of that era. An era when threatening clouds were settling over Europe, a time of dictators, as the Cardinal Secretary of State, Tarcisio Bertone, pointed out in the opening address of this conference, organized by the Pontifical Commission for Historical Sciences. When he stressed how the heads of state at the time of the pontificate of Pius XI numbered well 5 dictators. Closer to home, Mussolini, who rose to power 8 months after the Pope's election, and further afield, Salazar in Portugal, Hitler in Germany, Franco in Spain, and Stalin in the Soviet Union. A dramatic era I brought you echoes of in the first of my recent series. In a few moments, on a far lighter note, the fourth and final part of these programmes, I'll be bringing you echoes of the pomp and circumstance of that era, when, while across Europe, the roaring 20s were in full swing, and the Vatican held on to all the trappings of a medieval court. Make yourselves comfortable and join me then as I step back in time, bringing you yet another crackly recording of the voice of the founder of our radio station. as, on a more serious note, he blesses the crowds gathered around him.
Pius XI blessing the crowds shortly after his election. It was 1922 and the newly elected Pope had just accomplished a momentous gesture. He'd appeared to the astonished crowds gathered in St. Peter's Square for the first time in almost 60 years. Shortly after this first reconciliatory gesture between the Vatican and Italy, Pius XI returned within Vatican walls to meet with his brother.
Yes, with his brother. He received him after having been elected, and his brother spoke to him and spoke on during a few minutes, and having no reply at all. So there was a gap in the conversation, and the Pope broke it and told him, I can't
As a child, Father John Charles Roux, whose father was French ambassador to the Holy See, mixed in Vatican circles.
You are here, and you haven't yet called me Your Holiness. But he had his tongue in his cheek when he told him that.
His own brother?
His own brother. Mm. But in those times, I must say, the respect one showed to popes was very different from what it is now. One always genuflected 3 times before reaching them. One remained on one's knees before one asked. He asked you to appear to stand up and take a seat. So, I suppose, in a way, he was preserving the aura of august sovereign that was the custom in those times for the popes.
Pius XI was pope then, Paparatti. I remember going to an audience as a child. I can't think why I was taken along.
Unlike Father Charles Roux, Princess Orietta Doria Pamphili did not mix in Vatican circles, yet she too remembered a special aura connected with the Pope, an aura that as a child she identified with what may seem like rather an unusual object, the Pope's box.
No, it was the only time I think I remember going to an audience. But we did have what my mother called the Pope's box. I think it was an old chocolate box, a large box, with the Pope's box written on it. Because people had to have long dresses and veils and black stockings and black gloves, which, of course, people didn't usually have with them. She had a box with stockings, gloves and veils, which she dished out to visiting friends who were going to audiences and needed them.
While Princess Doria Pamphili's mother came to the rescue of those who had not packed suitable garments for meeting with Pius XI, not everybody came unprepared. Sir John Leslie's father never came to Rome without his very splendid uniform.
He became a chamberlain to Pope Pius XI.
What did that entail?
Well, he was supernumerary, actually. If you're called on for duty, you have to attend and wear that rather fine uniform. It's now abolished now, 17th century type of uniform, papal chamberlains, if you went on duty.
It was a black uniform?
Black with a ruff, as far as I remember. I'm afraid he never wore it. I wish he had. Could have had his picture painted in it.
So I thought it was only the lot of the Italian aristocracy to be in attendance of the Pope.
A chamberlain could be any nationality. Lord Tredegar was a knight of cape and sword, for instance, several foreigners were.
People who belonged to the aristocracy?
Well, not necessarily, but usually. And he had done a lot for the Catholic Church in Wales. He was a convert too. Evan Morgan, the Catholic poet, became Viscount Tredegar. And so he had his portrait painted by Kathleen Mann, Lady Queensbury, in his ruff and sword and all.
Was your family always Catholic?
My father became a Catholic when he was at Cambridge, age 20. Monsignor Barnes, the Catholic chaplain, really converted him to the intense annoyance of our very, very Protestant family. But it was all quite smooth in the end.
Anybody that belonged to a noble family, even if not Roman, could have access at the noble guard corps.
Like all noble guards, Marquis Mario Teodoli's father kept the uniform he wore at papal ceremonies in a special dressing room inside the Vatican.
The noble guards represented a high class guardian the name of the Pope and the Pope, and they followed the Pope.
So it was an extraordinary procession, and all those uniforms of those different charges were of different times. So it was both the structure of a Christian society and the unity of civilized Christian civilization throughout the centuries. From Renaissance or medieval costumes in the monks, for instance, medieval, Renaissance in most of the civil charges of the court, and then 19th century for the noble guards, which were a little like the guards of the Goldstream guards of the Queen.
So it was really an aesthetic court. That was the feeling in those days, wasn't
it? Well, it was very beautiful to see. I remember many canonizations, beatifications, and the ceremonies of the Vatican, which were much longer than they are now, and with a display.
As a young man, Father Charles Leroux sat through many lengthy papal ceremonies. After all, Pius XI did canonize 34 people, including St. Therese of Lisieux, St. John Vianney, better known as the Curé of Ars, St. Thomas More, and St. John Bosco.
Not only a procession of time, but a procession of all the structures of a society. You had the clerics of different ranks, the guards, the judges, the barristers, the heads of all the services of the Vatican, which were hereditary, but it was nevertheless the hospitals. Prince Ruspoli was the hereditary head of all the hospitals of the Holy See, under the protection of the Holy See, the great master of the post, who was Prince Massimo, the great master of the horse, the bearer of the flag of Rome, of Imperial Rome, which was one of the Marquis of Baldacchino, which was Marquis Sacchetti, the commander of the noble guards, and then the free arms, the noble guards, the Swiss guards, and the Palatine guards, which correspond to different sections of society, and then dominated by the throne on which was the Pope. He was under the baldacchino, so dressed up that you couldn't recognize one Pope from another. Up to the chin, it was white. The mitre or the tiara was on the forehead. You could hardly recognize a person from only the tip of his nose and his lips. And therefore it was not a person, it was the Pope himself, very much the Vicar of Christ. And then there was the church. It was very sensational. Before the procession came in, there were the silver trumpets sounding a very beautiful tune. And as it advanced, there was a crescendo in the silver trumpets.
Pius XI may not have brought changes to papal pomp and circumstance, but he was definitely an innovator. He was the first pope to leave the Vatican for almost 60 years and the first pope ever to use a car. By 1930, the first Vatican number plate had appeared. For a long time, it was the only one. Every time a different car was used, it was ceremoniously attached. By 1931, he'd inaugurated the Vatican's own radio station. And by 1935, he'd had the Vatican Observatory moved out of Rome to Castel Gandolfo. The excessive electric light in town had made it impossible to see the sky. Despite these signs of the times, the era of Pius XI remained one of pomp and circumstance. Yet on one occasion, peals of laughter rang out in the papal palace.
He also had a sense of humour, because I remember you had a minister, the British, to the Holy See. Your embassy is quite a recent one, but there was a minister, you had a legation, and the minister of Great Britain to the Holy See was called Sir Horace Wingfield. And Lady Wingfield, who died only a few years ago, she lived to about 100. Their daughter married an Italian and was a very pretty woman, but how can I say? She spoke before thinking. And when Horace Wingfield, Sir Horace, presented his letters of credentials to the Pope, she wasn't there. She was in England. So she didn't have an audience immediately after her husband, the ambassador, so the wife of the minister, comes in after the official ceremony and the ambassador introduces his wife, his family, and so on. So when she came back, she had a private audience of the Pope to make up for her absence at the official audience. And Sir Horace had recommended her, as she spoke a little through her hat, just say yes and no, yes and no, yes and no. So she had her audience. And the day after the audience, Sir Horace, in his visit to the Secretary of State, learned that the Pope had tremendously enjoyed the visit of Lady Wingfield, and that one had never seen him laughing so much. So when Sir Horace went back to the legation, he asked Lady Wingfield, "What did you tell the Pope? I told you, say, could limit yourself to yes and no." She said, "Yes, of course I limited myself to yes and no." But he was speaking in French, so I said, "Oui, Saint-Siège."
Saint-Siège means the Holy See.
"Non, Saint-Siège. Oui, Saint-Siège. Non, Saint-Siège." I saw he was laughing, so I changed, and I said, "Oui, Sacré-Père. Non, Sacré-Père," which is swearing in French.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the fourth in my series of programs focusing on the figure of Pius the 11th. Finally, to end the broadcast, I'd like to pick up on a character centerpiece in Benedict XVI's weekly general audience a few weeks ago. He's one of our most popular monks and most learned men of the Middle Ages. You may have guessed, the Venerable Bede. The Pope's words focusing on the Venerable Bede reminded me of a conversation I had with his Latinist, Father Reginald Foster. On this occasion, I bullied our popular Latin lover to speak of this monk in a rather curious manner. So join me for our weekly rendezvous with him. The brothers on Lindisfarne, where he lived at one point, asked him to write the biography of their great saint, Cuthbert. Have you read the biography of the great Saint Cuthbert?
No.
Cuthbert was a shepherd boy who, at the age of 15, had a vision while watching sheep.
Yeah, I don't know. I know people by the name of Cuthbert.
How do you say a shepherd boy had a vision while watching sheep?
Custodiens oves accepit visionem puer.
And then he had lots of wild stories about Cuthbert, for example, in snakes. He said, "No reptile is to be seen in Ireland." How would he have said that in Latin, in his beautiful Latin?
Serpentes nullas videri licet in Hibernia.
No snake can live there.
Neque ibi vivere possunt.
For although snakes have often been taken there from Britain, as the boat approaches the land, they are affected by the scent of its air and perish. In other words, snakes perish in Ireland. How do you say that?
Periunt serpentes in Hibernia.
In fact, almost everything that comes from that island gives protection against poison.
Oh, my. Fere omnia quae ibi nascuntur presidium adversus venenam prebent.
For example, when people were suffering from snake bite, well, he said there weren't any snakes, but in Ireland, so I don't know why he says this, but we have seen leaves of manuscripts from Ireland scraped, and the scrapings dropped in water and given as a drink. And this treatment immediately took away all the pain of spreading poison and completely reducing the swelling.
Yeah, that's interesting.
How do you say all that in Latin?
No, I'm not going to.
Yes, you are.
You can.
Okay, an antidote against snake bite.
Remedium adversus serpentium morsus.
Manuscripts from Ireland, scraped and the scrapings dropped in water and given as a drink.
Codices ex Hibernia illate. What are you going to say? Scalpe bantur et reliquiae aqua mice bantur.
And took away all the pain of spreading poison and completely reduced the swelling.
What is spreading poison?
Well, the poison, the snake poison.
Took away the pain of spreading poison.
Yeah.
Abule, hecomi abstulerum dolores veneni serpentis.
And completely reduced the swelling.
Et omnino compescuit tumorem.
What is this
all about, Cuthbert?
Yeah.
Oh, Lord.
In the life of Cuthbert, it's about animals. We have Cuthbert, who immersed himself in the cold North Sea and emerged to be dried by two otters. This is from the life of Cuthbert, from Bede's life of Cuthbert, right?
Yeah.
And basically what happened was that one night one of the brothers of the monastery saw him going silently out. This was Cuthbert, no? And they secretly followed in his footsteps to discover where he was going and what his purpose was. It's like spying on him, no? How do you say spying?
Speculabantur eum.
Anyway, this was night time, no? When dawn approached, he went onto the land and again began to pray, kneeling on the shore. As he did so, there at once came out from the depths of the sea 2 4-footed creatures, which are commonly called otters.
Otters? What are otters? Oh, I know otters, like sea lions or something.
Well, we can call them like that.
I don't even know. I don't know. I don't know my animals.
Okay, well, how do you say otters came out of the sea?
Bene, quadrupedes emergerunt de mari.
Stretching themselves out in front of him on the sand, they began to warm his feet with their breath.
Oh.
How do you say that?
Say in arena, protendentes, well, extendentes, ceperunt calefacere eus pedes.
And sought to dry him on their fur, like there were beach towels or something.
Intelligo, bene. Suaque pelle eum arefacere.
Like beach towels?
Abstergere.
He didn't say that, I did.
No, I understand. What are you going to say? Manu tergia maritima. Sea towels.
They're beach towels. How do you say beach?
They didn't have a word. They didn't have no litus. Litoria. Manu tergia litoria.
And warm thanks there to Father Reginald Foster, the Pope's own Latinist, wishing him the speediest of recoveries so we can go back to recording once again. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks for listening. We'll be back again at the same time tomorrow. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org. Bye for now.
Laudetur Jesus Christus.